American Literature Podcast 4, The Scarlet Letter, Chapters 6 through 12. Puritan theology encourages people to dig up each other's sins, or at least the Puritan theology as Hawthorne presents it in The Scarlet Letter. Hawthorne tells us they shrink from displaying themselves black and filthy in the view of men, because thenceforward no good can be achieved by them, no evil of the past be redeemed by better service. Now, I said it was Hawthorne who said that. I also earlier said it was Puritan theology. But the line that I just quoted actually comes from Dimmesdale. Dimmesdale is a fictional character. His lines are part of how Hawthorne represents Puritan theology. And that, I think, is a really important thing to note when you're studying literature. An artist who paints a sunset makes a representation of a sunset. We can look at different artists and maybe use what we know about sunsets or how artists have represented sunsets in general. We can use that information to teach us something about the author, about the values of the author, about the point of view the author wants to get across. But a painting of a sunset isn't a sunset. So we can't learn anything about the chemical makeup of the air that causes these particular light refractions or anything else when we're looking at a painting. These words that Dimmesdale speaks, he says, no good can be achieved by somebody who displays themselves as black and filthy. No evil of the past can be redeemed by better service. Hawthorne critiques this element of Puritan society in The Young Goodman Brown, which shows Brown becomes embittered. He doesn't have a moral mechanism that allows him to think of human beings as moral creatures, even though they are flawed and sinful. Hester is fighting against this black and white worldview. She makes a preemptive strike against Governor Bellingham's interest in taking Pearl away from her. Hawthorne tells us that it had reached her ears, that is, Hester's ears, that the governor is planning on taking Pearl away. Now, we don't actually see how Hester learns this. We don't know how it reaches her ears. I mean, someone must talk to her, or at least, you know, talk in her vicinity for her to overhear. But Hawthorne doesn't choose to show us these scenes of Hester interacting with others in daily life. Instead, we get this really stylized representative vignette. As the two wayfarers came within the precincts of the town, the children of the Puritans looked up from their play, or what passed for play with those somber little urchins, and spoke gravely to one another. Here they're going to speak like no human child has ever spoken, and their quote ends with, "Come therefore and let us throw mud at them." Hawthorne comes right out and says these kids aren't really playing. They're just somber little copies of somber Puritans, and what they do in their spare time isn't play. It just passes for play. This is Hawthorne writing outside this tradition, critiquing it. And we as the reader are supposed to take these details, and we think of these little children as intolerant cardboard cutouts. And that really sets up the scene for us to be even more sympathetic to Hester and Pearl. But let's remember, Hawthorne is representing reality. He's not actually giving us reality. Just as supermodels use super makeups and super photographers to create their look, here we see Hawthorne using super language. He's using exaggerated language, that the language is overly stiff and overly formal in this encounter with the children, in order to create an emotional reaction in the reader. Even the everyday language of these children throwing mud sounds poetic and elevated and lofty. He's not using language realistically, putting a tape recorder in front of the way people speak and trying to record exactly how they speak with all the stumbles and the mumbles and with the things like that that people really say when they're talking. Now, in this chapter, after Hawthorne describes that Pearl is wearing a red dress embroidered with gold thread, in the very next paragraph, in case we didn't notice it, he says that this red dress irresistibly and inevitably always reminded the beholder of the Scarlet Letter. And in the next sentence, he says, Pearl was the Scarlet Letter in another form. She was the Scarlet Letter endowed with life. Now the little Puritan urchins notice it. They say, there is the likeness of the Scarlet Letter running along by her side. And a little later, Hester herself blurts out, speaking of Pearl, she is the Scarlet Letter only capable of being love. Okay, do you think Hawthorne wants us to see a connection? Yes, he does. It's not at all subtle. We can also say much the same thing with several different references to sunlight. A Pearl desires the sunlight to be stripped from the governor's mansion and given to her, for instance, but inside the mansion, Hester is standing in shadow when the men arrive and see Pearl, and the governor compares Pearl to a vision of light cast through a stained glass window. So we have the light and shadow thing going there. Now, these images are central to the content of the book. They help Hawthorne tell his story. Hawthorne directly compares Chillingworth to the devil, and Dimmesdale directly says he himself is utterly a pollution and a lie. Now, in this section of the book, the relationship between the characters really start to take a solid shape, and Hawthorne makes these points numerous times because they're part of the structure of the story that he wants to tell. If we're going to interpret a literary work, our task really has to go beyond simply noticing and listing these structures, and noticing and listing our emotional reactions to the setting or the events or the plot that are put in place. So, for an interpretation, if you were to say something like, the authorities should not have been so harsh with Hester, well, you might feel that in your heart of hearts. I think that's a perfectly appropriate response. But Hawthorne created a scenario in which we had a heroine who was in a harsh situation. Let's take another example. If you were to say, the townspeople are so slow to appreciate Hester's charity, they really should have recognized and appreciated her good works. All right, Hawthorne, I think, would agree with you. Hawthorne created this whole scenario, a strict society, in order to test the character of his sympathetic heroine, in order to get us to notice this character. Hester would not be such a strong moral figure if she had lived in a more forgiving society. Now that society, as distasteful as Hawthorne means for us to consider it, that intolerant society is responsible for creating the Hester character that we care about. And if your response to this literary work is to love Hester and hate the society, recognize that they are both fictional creations, and Hawthorne wants that tension to fall into place. Wilson says that as long as the father's identity remains a mystery, he says, every good Christian man hath a title to show a father's kindness towards the poor deserted babe. Well, now, wait a minute. Wilson says every good Christian should be kind to the baby. Does that sound like a harsh, cruel patriarchy? Hawthorne here is really sort of going out of his way to end this interview with an image of the Puritan leaders taking the high road. Now, it's certainly Hester's Hester's emotional plea that God gave the child to her probably has something to do with this. But we've seen these sober, serious Puritans have a very hard time dealing with Pearl's caprice. She's really associating Pearl's behavior, this whimsy, this attitude that makes her seem very much like a real child to us, not a cardboard cutout. Hawthorne shows these people associating Pearl's attitude with magic and witchcraft and willfulness, and oh my gosh, she's an individual. Things like that are presented in this story as kind of freaking these Puritans out. But, you know, again, it's a little bit complex from that. We've just got a situation where Hester seems sort of to have won out, and Hawthorne softens the image of these Puritans they are sincere in their belief that they are concerned with Hester's soul and Pearl's soul. But here we have a scene where we don't want this magic to be crushed out of her. So there's a sense here where this whimsical stuff, which again it's dangerous, it's risky, it's associated with demons and magic. There's a slight bit here where maybe we're thinking, okay, the magic is good and the Puritans are bad. But in this very scene, Hester is on her way out. We see she has an encounter with Governor Bellingham's bitter-tempered sister, who tries to tempt Hester into the woods to meet the black man. Here we have an ugly and bitter woman that Hawthorne tells us in this scene that she would soon be executed for witchcraft. But here this woman is trying to tempt Hester into the forest, to tempt her with magic. Hester tells her no, she's got to stay home with Pearl. And Hawthorne ends this chapter by pointing out, even thus early had the child saved her from Satan's snare. Chapter 9 walks us through the relationship of Chillingworth and Dimmesdale as it develops. They both share a scholarly outlook on life. Now, you may remember from the novel's beginning, Chillingworth was delayed in his travel from England to Salem because he was captured by Indians. And during that captivity, he learned native medicines. Now, this is a sort of hat tip. It's a brief reference to a long tradition of Indian captivity narratives, that is, stories that early Americans told about settlers being kidnapped and made honorary members of the tribe, generally against their will at the beginning, but often they would marry and raise families. Chillingworth seems to have learned from his encounter with the natives, not just the medicine and the sort of encounter with, tribal heathen religions, but Chillingworth uses the idea of captivity. I mean, he proceeds to snare Dimmesdale. It's not a literal captivity, but it's a psychological one. And just as Chillingworth picked up Indian cultures and Indian medical practices during his captivity, during Dimmesdale's captivity, he sort of unwittingly lets Chillingworth keep that wound open, keep his moral wound open by not letting him rest, by continuing to prod and prick at his conscience. He's confronted with the evidence of his failing health, and he tells his congregation, "I need no medicine," which is true. Hawthorne has told us that Dimmesdale is dying because of the turmoil in his soul, and so when Dimmesdale tells his flock it's not medicine that he needs, he's being true to his understanding of his plight. Anyway, I do think it would be a bit misguided to look at the medical symptoms that Hawthorne gives us and try to diagnose the real medical problem Dimmesdale is suffering from. Is it, ulceritis or post-traumatic stress disorder or something? I say this would be misguided because there is no Arthur Dimmesdale to diagnose. This is a work of fiction, and to look here for medical clues is just not necessary. Okay, when Dimmesdale and Chillingworth share lodgings, Hawthorne presents a particular piece of art. It's a tapestry depicting the story of David and Bathsheba. Now, David was a biblical king who fell in love with Bathsheba and impregnated her while her husband was away fighting in the king's wars. And not only had David committed adultery, but he compounded his crime by ordering that Bathsheba's husband be put on the front lines and abandoned, thus leading to his death. So, and the Bible, by the way, describes King David as spying on Bathsheba while she was bathing. I'm sure it was just a coincidence that the story was a very popular scene for artists to paint. But actually, in addition to the bathing scene, this story is also famous because a prophet eventually does get to David's conscience by telling him a parable. So here, the setting really echoes Dimmesdale's complex situation, that the tapestries represent his passionate nature, constantly reminding him of his sin, and he's in his library where he's trying to do his priestly duty. Chapter 10 gives us the four characters united again. Hester happens to be passing by, and Pearl is dancing on someone's grave. Pearl forces an interaction between Hester and Dimmesdale. It's a very early interaction. Pearl has been putting burrs around the Scarlet Letter on her mother's breast, and she throws one at Dimmesdale. Now, Hawthorne tells us that Hester did not pluck them off. It's a very understated response. But Dimmesdale, we're told, shrank with nervous dread as this little burr, as this little prickly thing, comes flying at him. And really, that's a pretty important hint about what's going on in this novel. Pearl seems to be making that connection. Okay, Hester has an outlet for her moral turmoil. She can try to teach Pearl. But chapter 11 shows us Dimmesdale, he feels hollow, preaching messages to his flock, but unable to really get, he doesn't confess. He's bearing that guilt silently. Hawthorne tells us that Dimmesdale will stand before a mirror with a lit lamp and stare into his own reflection. And in case we didn't get that, Hawthorne tells us, he thus typified the constant introspection wherever he went. Staring at your own reflection in a mirror is trying to get to know yourself. Hester has Pearl, but Hawthorne comes right out and says, the only truth that continued to give Mr. Dimmesdale a real existence on this earth was the anguish in his inner soul. I'm going to end this podcast on that note. We will see some changes in the story starting with chapter 13 as we see some new possibilities, we see some new risks, we see some new temptations, I guess. Watch for this power shift. Now, it is not at all subtle. We know Dimmesdale is fading. We know Hester is rising in her social stature. We'll see that starting with the next couple chapters. Pursue the uncertainty. Pursue the awkward moment. Pursue the passage that you don't quite understand, rather than grasping, here's another connection between Pearl and the Scarlet Letter. We know that. Hawthorne is really giving that to us right up front. It's what we do with those, I think. It's the unusual questions we ask with those that give us a lot more to talk about. Okay, happy reading, and I'll see you in class.